forum on Poland Ecology and World Crisis, a helpful link. My name is Jeff Merkel. I'm pastor at University Lutheran in Philadelphia. We have some folks here tonight to be panelists on this topic. Julie, who's been working on the third level a bit. Steve, over here, who's been around Poland for quite a while. Kirk. And Rick Dunning, who has not been around Poland in a while, but who is our geographer and geologist in the past couple of weeks. The reason that I wanted to pull this group of people together is because I saw some of these folks from Poland's operations staff do a session last year when I was here on Poland ecology and found it to be one of the very most intriguing of the... going to give us an answer to that in a minute. I think that the way that Poland deals with the issue of ecology is one of the more exciting aspects of this place. I think the people here have been very faithful in looking at alternatives to the way that society has been dealing with issues of waste, issues of energy, issues of recycling and whatnot. I think that this is one of the unsung stories these days, however, because a lot of these things that were put into place a few years back, and people continue the effort, but sometimes don't get a chance to sit down together and talk about what they're doing and why they're doing it, and what some of their experiences and feelings are about it. People here at Holden who have been deeply involved in this. So that's why I asked these operations folks to come here tonight. And I asked Rick to come here to give us a sort of a world overview, because we are becoming more and more aware that ecology is not just something that we do in a municipality or in a place like Holland or in our own homes, but it really has, there are bigger things going on these days. And so the question needs to be asked, does what we do, the small efforts that we undertake or the large efforts we undertake, how do they contribute to a whole ecological ethic? So I'll turn the floor over to Steve, who will talk a little bit about the garbage situation here at Holden and some efforts.
I thought first I'd tell a story of the recent origins of garbology as we have it today and some of the things we've done these past year and a half. End of April last year, we had a day where the whole village went up to the second level of tailings to pick up garbage from the tailings and from the creek that had blown away over the winter and the spring. But before the Forest Service inspectors came up to inspect the site, it was like a yearly ritual, was to go up to the creek and pick all the garbage out of the creek and off the tailings pile before the inspectors came. And went up last year in April, and the whole village was up there, and it was just pretty incredible how much junk was around. It became pretty apparent that Holden Village had done a lot of talking about ecology and things like that. When it come down to what we're doing with our own garbage, it was pretty irresponsible. And so there was a lot of anger even that day. People were really fired up. And that's from that day sort of came the idea of like having garbage be more of a focus of the summer and the focus of the whole year, to have a lot higher profile than it had in the past. So then someone had the idea of having garbage teams to have all the staff do the garbage pickup and sorting they've done in the past, do it with a team instead of having one or two people assigned to that job, which would spread around the responsibility and the just spread around the awareness of our garbage we produce here at Holden. And also from that day also came the third level project sort of was born that day also. People just take a lot closer look at the way Holden had disposed of their garbage in the third level's case, old appliances and stuff we no longer wanted in the village. The garbage program as we have it now, give you kind of an idea what we do with stuff. The stuff in summer is like picked up daily by the garbage team, and then it gets sorted into burnable things like paper and such. Cardboard is recycled, sent out and recycled. Tin cans are sent out and recycled. Aluminum cans are sent out and recycled. Plastics and stuff like aerosol cans are buried along with styrofoam. And what else is there?
Glass
is also, glass is recycled and was sorted and sent out and recycled. And the compost is composted in the compost bin. There's a lot of, not enough fingers. But then the burnables are burned in the incinerator on the second level. We have an incinerator that's made to burn garbage. The compost bins are on the second level. The variable things like the plastics and the non-recyclable metals are buried in the tailings pile. There's a spot in the tailings where we've buried those over the past 20 years. The sort of idea is. That cut down to a minimum the amount of stuff we have to bury, because the buried stuff will be around forever, basically, and it'll never go away. And in some ways, it's easy to get away with burying a lot of stuff, because when you see the tailings are such a big, immense pile, it seems like a small percentage of that is actually garbage. But that's sort of a cop-out to think that way. We need to be really careful in what we bury, because it just is around forever, basically. And also the burning of this stuff is a pretty efficient way to get rid of it. But even that's not, you know, obviously not the best way either, because it adds pollutants to the air. And also the ash has a lot of, like when you burn things like ink, there's a lot of heavy metals left in the ash, which is a pollutant, basically. And let's see, other garbage things. So I guess getting on the point, the best way to use the garbage, like the garbage stuff, is to reuse this stuff is the best way to go about, you know, getting rid of garbage, is to reuse it or not to make it in the first place. So we've also tried to hit that angle a little bit. Last year, people started to try to reduce the amount of garbage we produce or only use stuff we can reuse. So one of the things was the store stopped selling candy in plastic wrappings, or like gum. They stopped doing gum because gum was getting, the wrappers are everywhere. And also the foil stuff is basically not recyclable. It's aluminum, but it's not recyclable. And so they did stuff like that. And our store also stopped selling disposable diapers. They just sell cloth diapers now. There's a few things like that. We also sent out some letters. We changed our purchase orders to say, do not ship anything in plastic or styrofoam. And we also, Mike Schramm, the operation manager, made up a letter, which I can pass around. We sent to all our people, to all our suppliers, to stop sending stuff in styrofoam and plastic. There's also a lot of little things were changed, like we started buying soap in bulk containers, 55-gallon or 40-gallon bulk containers, to save the little 1-gallon plastic packaging. And we, not just soap, other things also. We bought a lot of different things in bulk instead of buying the small plastic things. And also, like with the snack bar ice cream buckets, they try to get for a while they were sending those in paper, but they started sending in plastic buckets then. So then last summer we said, don't send any more plastic buckets, just send paper, because we can't get rid of the plastic. And so they said, well, just send us out the plastic and we'll reuse it. When in fact we started sending out the plastic, they started sending in paper. Then by the end of the summer, they were sending everything in paper because they didn't want to mess with the plastic, I assume that's the reason. But it actually was available in paper, as it turned out. Then at least last summer it was. I'm not sure what's happening with the plastic, with the buckets and the snack bar. Maybe somebody in the snack bar can knows what's happening with those.
There he goes.
And then I'll say a few more. I got a few more things here. These three are letters we got back from suppliers. We just happened to have these. Kirk and I just found these in a file. There are three letters we got back from places like we're receiving our letter about Styrofoam. And we got some pretty good responses from some companies that are changing their way they're packaged up because of pressure from people like Holden Village, who sent letters to say, you know, just all we want is biodegradable things or burnable things. It's kind of interesting. Another company said they can't really change the way they package stuff, but they try to package stuff for us in paper. And it's quite a hassle, really, trying to get people to send paper, because there's a few of us tried to order things from some companies, and they just insist on sending Styrofoam angel poop, as we call it here, the Styrofoam peanuts. And it's almost impossible to make them stop sending the angel poop, but they do eventually. But we start sending it back to them also. It's another option to do sometimes. I'll pass these around. Also, there's a paper written by Kent Burgess, the operation manager, last April after that cleanup day. He was pretty fired up, and he sat down on his computer that night and cranked this thing out, which is really pretty. It's pretty good, I think. It's kind of interesting overview of all that.
Great.
Okay. Right now, I'm working on the third level, and I guess I got involved with this a little bit last summer when I came. I worked up on the third level a little bit, and my duty for about a week, just moving stuff around, and then it turned out I stayed here the winter, and I was the garbologist after Steve, so I got to look at a lot of garbage for about 5 months. And
tell us what the third level is.
The third level?
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone's walked up there, but if you walk up the road, you run into the garage, and then you go towards the portal, and if you keep going up the hill, you'll end up on the third level. And basically, it's Holden Village's junkyard and a building foot left from the mine, and a lot of scrap metal, some junk, and the recycling center that we set up this summer with John Swift, the garbologist who has been here, just left. So my task is to kind of help hopefully finish or catch up to what Steve was talking about that they started up last summer, and that is to sort the metals that are up there, cut them up if they need to so we can ship them out, and hopefully to minimize the metals that are brought up there. Even this spring after the Narnia project, there was a lot of pipe and wire and miscellaneous metals that were left up there, and sometimes when I'm up there sorting and moving things around, hopefully setting them up so that we can take them up out and give them to the barge so that they eventually will be recycled. I hope that I'm not going to be a permanent fixture up there, or someone like me, and that maybe we won't have all these metals accumulating, and we'll think twice before we buy something or throw it away. Maybe we can use it for something else, or maybe we didn't need it in the first place, because it's amazing. A lot of people that come up there and ask me what I'm doing, they think it's the stuff that was left from the mining company. It really isn't. Most of it is Holden Village's stuff, so it is our stuff. And I hope in the future that we will think about it and think about what we're doing up there. Are we going to clean it up, or are we just going to clean it up for now, or is it going to be a future? Is it going to be a recycling center?
So it's a real commitment by Holden to change, to go into its own dump and right. Try to take that stuff which was put up there for 20 years,
yeah.
and to get it out of up there. But also stuff keeps going back up there. That's an interesting problem, mm-hmm. question.
Interesting that this summer, last summer, more than 280,000 pounds has been hauled off at third level. Yeah. So over 140 tons of scrap metal. What's that?
How much is holding it for that?
We trade the metal for the barge shipping, so.
So you get nothing. We just get rid of it.
It was actually a lot cheaper than we thought we were going to do it. That would cost a lot of money to do it, so it was actually a lot cheaper than we first anticipated.
I was going to talk about a couple of things we've done in the village here over the last couple of years. When I came about 2 years ago, I think there was kind of a little different mentality about how we spend our money or spent our money at Holden.
Can you talk a little louder?
Sure. Sure. I think that that we weren't maybe as frugal as we could have been, and I think that over the last 2 years we've really had a change in heart or a change in thinking about what we do with the resources that we have here at Holden. One of the things that Steve and I worked on a little bit last summer was our goal was to cut our diesel usage in half. The year prior, we had burned about 16,000 gallons in diesel and heating over the winter, and we built a little project over here that's just above Chalet 1. If you've seen the block building up there, that heats five buildings on Chalet Hill with a central heating plant that's fired with wood now. And through that and some replumbing over in the hotel, closing some buildings, and then reworking also some of the electrical systems so that it utilized as much of our generating capacity as we could, we were able to, this past winter, we burned 2,500 gallons of diesel. So in 1 year, we approximately dropped 13,000-14,000 gallons of diesel in, wow, in 1 year. So we met our goal, I guess. And the end goal is, of course, not to use diesel and hopefully not depend on that as a source. It's very expensive for us, because we buy it at the pump in Chelan, and then we have to transport it up lake, and then of course up to the village itself. And it's also a messy thing, and underground storage tanks are becoming a factor for us now, and so there are a lot of factors in diesel. Another thing is one thing that I mentioned was utilizing our generating capacity, and Steve has done a lot of work in that, and a number of years ago, if you've been long-time Holden people who've been here over the last 10 years, you know that Holden was considering putting in a hydro in the early 80s. We, as you might or might not know, we did not do that. And I think that over the last few years, there's become a realization that we have a great gift in the hydro that we have, and there really is an abundance of power. But we have to learn how to use that, and it seems that often we tend to, if there's a shortage, we want to make more. So in this case, if there's a shortage of electricity, we want to generate more, and that's why we needed the hydro. But I think in the last bit of time in Holden's history, we started to look at how are some other ways that we could get along with the generating capacity that we have and do something else, such as conserve, insulate, maybe not do with something, maybe decide that this isn't really what we need. The decision not to have the hydro was probably made mostly in economic reasons because it became prohibitively expensive. But we've expanded our winter program in the last two winters on the same hydro unit that we've had all along. And I think what's changed is maybe our mentality a little bit about what we need, and that's real hard, I think, for someone who's like myself, who's been here a couple years, and then you can sit and preach, and you've got other folks that come in, and we're still geared towards, if we don't have enough, where do we buy it? How do we get it? Well, here at Holden, we run, and that's how your utility out there, they have to supply what you demand. So you turn on switches, they've got to supply that. Well, here at Holden, we've only got so much water coming down our pipe, so there's only X amount of electricity that we can generate. If we can generate 100 kilowatts, that's all we can generate. There's no amount of prayers that we can give that'll generate 101. And so if you demand more than 100 kilowatts, the power goes out. And that's what happens in the winter. The power goes out a lot. And so what we do here is, instead of generating more electricity, we curb people's consumption. And so it's a different way of looking at it, and it's a unique situation that only Holden is probably in, because we are a community, and we all live together, and we generate our own power. But it's another way of looking at it, which I don't think we look at very often, is what do we really need, and what can we get along without?
It comes down very concretely to when you can take a shower, when you can use hot water in the winter community. And it's all figured out for you. You can't use hair dryers when people are drying dishes in the kitchen, things like that, because if you turn one more hair dryer, somebody's going to run all the way up to the hydro and turn it back on. And that doesn't make people happy.
2 winters ago, to give you an example, the jacuzzi up here, the heater for the jacuzzi is quite a big load. It's 24,000 watts. 2 winters ago, when we hit our low for generating, as the winter goes along, the water flow becomes less and less and less and less. Our maximum generating capacity at one point 2 winters ago was 27,000 kilowatts. So that would have been, if we had run the jacuzzi, we couldn't have run anything else. We could have run the heater and the pumps, and everything else would have been out. So, you know, your hair dryer is maybe 15,000 or 1,500 watts into 27,000 watts. You can see that there couldn't be too many people blowing their hair at one time.
Is there, on that hydro unit, is there 2 units there, like an auxiliary one that can, are there 2 units? Because I see
right.
Water coming out of here.
Right.
There's one over here.
There are 2 units, and we use one in the winter, and it seems to work better on low flows. And we use one in the summer, and it has larger buckets on it, and it can create, it generates more electricity. And so that's why we use them. We can also use them both together and split the village in half. But generally, we run one at a time, one in the winter, one in the summer. We also were just batting around the idea this afternoon of maybe, since everything is a hike around here, we used to have ceiling hikes you used to walk around on the ceiling, and then Gertrude would tell you what all the stuff on the ceiling meant over in the village center. She'd give you these little suction cups for your... But everything's a hike here, but we thought about maybe having a technology hike to kind of show you. So if there's some interest, maybe you should collar us after this, and we could maybe do that. We could tour the hydro and some of the other things that we've all mentioned.
One of the things that's terribly interesting about Holden is that it is a closed environment in some ways, and so all of these issues are issues. If we throw garbage out in 1968, it's still there for us in 1989. And the reason I wanted Rick to talk was because he can give us a sense of the closed space of the world and where we stand at this point. A lot of stuff has been in Time magazine, other periodicals, weather changes and whatnot. Rick has had a forum on this last week. I just thought maybe a little bit of that perspective before we get to questions about ecology and about your own commitment to it.
Okay. As I thought about this, one way I could perhaps approach this is to ask you to think of yourselves as part of a vast and very complex resource utilization system. And I want you to think about some of the everyday resources that you use and what some of the other environmental ramifications of the use of those resources might be. Now, for example, when you get up in the morning and take a shower at home, do you know exactly where the water comes from that comes through your shower? Do you know how that water was treated? Do you know where that water goes once it goes down your drain? What kind of sewage treatment facility does that water go through? Once it's treated, where does that water enter back into the natural water system, and what kind of quality does it have? Think about electricity. When you turn on a light or your stereo at home, where did that electricity come from? If it was from a coal-fired generating plant, where did the coal come from? Was it strip mined from somewhere? If so, what happened to that land after the strip mining was through? What sort of recovery efforts were made? How was that coal transported? How much energy was used to carry that coal from the strip mine to the generating plant? How much heat was lost from that coal when they burned the coal to get the steam to turn the turbines to generate the electricity? Typically, over 50% of the energy from coal is lost as heat rather than as electricity. What happened to that heat? How was that turned back into the environment? How much carbon dioxide was generated when that coal was burned to generate the electricity used in that light? How much sulfur dioxide that created acid rain? How many PCBs are there in the electrical equipment that carries that current to your house? Or if we go to the automobile, where did the iron come from to make up the steel in that automobile? Where was the oil from that you burned as gasoline in that automobile? If it's from a foreign country, what kind of government are we supporting in order to be able to get that oil from that country? How was that oil refined? How much pollution was generated when that oil was turned into gasoline? How much pollution is generated when you drive your car down the road? How much carbon dioxide, how much in the way of nitrous oxides or ozone were generated in a simple trip to the grocery store? And lastly, think about where your food comes from. Where was that food grown? Do you really know? Can you really trace where your food came from? How much energy went into producing the food, to drive the tractors, to make the fertilizer that went into that food? How much fertilizer and pesticide was used on that food? Who raised the food crop? Did they get a fair wage for their picking of the food crop? How was it transported to the market? How was it processed? How much energy went into the processing of that food? How much plastic was used to package the food in the grocery store so that you could buy it? Or if you're eating a lot of meat, how much feed went into the animals that you're consuming as meat? And how was that feed raised? Were the animals treated humanely? How was the meat transported? How was it processed? These are just a few questions that kind of, after a while, get your mind sort of numb with the complexity of it all. The point I'm trying to make is that when we make consumer decisions in our everyday life, we have the decisions we make have implications that go way beyond just the simple choice of what food to buy or how much gasoline to burn or when to turn on our and off our lights. Our resource utilization systems are incredibly complex, and in that sense, incredibly mind-boggling if we try to think about it. Here at Holden, we have a little bit simpler system to work with. Some of these questions we can actually answer here. We may not be able to answer those questions when we think about it, the products we use outside of Holden, but here we can answer some of those questions. We know where our water comes from. We know where the electricity comes from and how much of it we can use. We know what happens to the sewage when we flush the toilets down here, and we have to be careful about that in the summertime when it's so full. we know at least a little bit about where the food comes from. And maybe a cook would have been another good person to have in this to talk about the decisions they make of who to purchase the food from and what kind of food to purchase and what quality of food to purchase. We know where the wood comes from that supplies the heat here. So we have a more of a self-contained system here, a self-contained resource utilization system. The decisions we make here don't have quite the complex ramifications they might have in the outside world. That doesn't mean that we can slack off in our thinking about these problems, but it gives us an opportunity to actually think about how much of these resources we use. How much garbage do we produce? How much sewage do we produce? Here's a chance to measure that. Here's a chance to try and get a handle on it and use that as part of the education that goes on for people who come through the village. And I think that's an important step in this kind of discussion process. The other question Jeff asked me to address is, can we make a difference as individuals? Does it really matter what we do when we think about the complexity of these resource systems and the kind of inertia that the world seems to have at the current time? Well, that's a harder question to answer. I would remind you of one event or set of events in the mid and late 70s. Remember the oil shortages, mid 70s and the late 70s. And remember the effects that those oil shortages had on energy prices and eventually on energy consumption in North America. And I would say that was one instance in which we as a people were successful in cutting back on our resource use and actually making a significant difference in the use of energy. Now, in the intervening time, because of events involving OPEC and other aspects of the world economy, energy prices have dropped. So we've gotten a little lazy about our energy use. But I still think that that suggests to us that on environmental matters, we can make significant progress. And I would invite you finally to think not of yourselves as individuals, but think of yourselves as parts of congregations. And start to think about what your congregation can do as a group of people and not so much what you as yourself can do. Try and think about initiating these kinds of discussions within your home congregations and to start to make some decisions or at least do some thinking and talking about these problems as a group. So it's not just you against the world, but it's you with your community of faith striving to be faithful stewards of God's creation. And I would invite you to think of it that way.
How about people out there? Have any of you noticed anything here at Holden that has changed your attitude about your own lifestyle? Have any of you who aren't on staff been on a garbology run, separated the stuff into different kinds of materials? Or how about somebody who is at Holden? Does anybody have any stories on the garbology? What does it feel like the first time you go out there and start separating stuff? Someone want to tell a story? What are the surprises?
I just kind of realized how filthy we were. I don't mean we're getting filthy through handling the garbage, but I mean... how we didn't pay any attention to whether it was a garbage pail or a paper pail. We just flung our peach into it or half-eaten peach or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does anybody here remember when they when you guys cleaned out the septic tank last year and the kind of stuff you came up with? Remember that?
I should tell us.
Chris did a display of the various things that showed up. What did he have on there?
This actually happened, but in January or somewhere in the February, later part of winter, there's a shelf above the toilet in the chalet that I live in that had a tube of contact lens cleaner that's probably about this big and long and narrow. And I reached for it at the same time that I just finished flushing the toilet, and I didn't catch it, and it went down into the toilet, and it was flushed right down in. I mean, I couldn't grab it or anything because the toilet was flushing. And when Chris one day was telling me about the fact that he was going to start to clean out the septic tank over here, he started telling me about all the kinds of stuff he found in it. And I says, well, Guy, you know, you ought to look for this contact lens stuff I lost about a few months ago. And I think it was only about 2 days later or so, I was in the kitchen, and I had dish team, and Chris comes running in. Is this your stuff? Is this your stuff? He had soaked it in lye or something for about an hour or two, and it was the exact. I still have it. Exact bottle of stuff. And so.
But it really dispels that myth that you can throw something away.
Right.
I mean, people come here thinking they can throw something away. You bring some plastic shampoo thing, you use up the shampoo, and you throw it away, and you think not of it. But if you're on a garbology team, the next day you have this plastic thing in your hand, and you're saying, God, why didn't these people take this out with them? Now we have to deal with it, you know? And so then we end up, Holden ends up burying it up on the tailings because it simply is, you can't get rid of this stuff. So much of the stuff that people bring in here can't be gotten rid of.
If you, I don't know where the statement that Kent wrote is, but in that he says that God didn't make solid waste disposal sites, and kind of that just because we think we live in a particularly beautiful spot, and for example, at the top of the lakes, Tahikan, they ship their garbage out. They compact it and ship it out and bury it in somebody else's nice spot that they live in. And that's one thing that Holden could do as well. We could ship all of our garbage out. But in some ways, it seems to be avoiding a little bit of the responsibility of dealing with our own waste. And so just because we think our particular location here is real beautiful, it doesn't mean that the folks down in Omak, where the landfill is, that their home isn't necessarily beautiful either.
But other perceptions, isn't it?
I guess I think of two things. I think awareness is sort of like the biggest thing about garbology. I mean, you know, I remember one day Carrie wasn't busy in the kitchen, so she sent me up to dig a compost bin out. It was a really nice foggy day, and I spent about 6 hours up there, and it was real interesting. We were all trying to figure out when we had corn on the cob, you know. I was like, when did we have this? I don't remember having this during the summer. And so that was just a real awareness process. Another time I remember being really angry, though, was when a whole big garbage plastic, one of the garbage containers, no one had sorted their garbage. So you have broken bottles in with food, in with pop, in with paper, in with plastic, and there you are sitting there with your gloves on, sorting this all out. And it's just gross, and you get really angry. And I think where that anger becomes effective is when I remember last summer when I first came up here, it was 9 weeks before I took it out. And we went out and we were all excited because we went to McDonald's in the morning for breakfast. And it was just amazing after being here for a couple months.
to walk in and see all this packaging. I mean, we were going to eat the food there. And we had one of those little plates that they put your breakfast in, and then something in the platter was in styrofoam, and then it was in plastic, and then it was in paper. And it's like, no, I'm just going to eat this here, you know? I mean, and then you throw it all in one garbage thing. And it's just incredibly stupid. I mean, styrofoam is like zero. It's like nothing. That's going to be here forever. I think that's one of the things I realized at Holden. There's no need for styrofoam, I mean, in a lot of settings. And so why have it? And so one way to transfer the anger about having to set up the trash is that I can get angry at McDonald's. I can tell McDonald's. I can tell, you know, that kind of transfer of anger is healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was only here for 3 weeks last summer, but I know that the first time I went home and I went to Target, I found that my favorite Target had switched from paper bags to plastic, and then I had anger just like that, and I know it was because of being here. And I talked to the manager of the store and wrote out a comment card and sent a letter, and they said they got a lot of complaints about it, and they actually changed back to paper, mm-hmm. which made me feel real good. But I've been encountering that a lot back in the Twin Cities, and I think it's been helpful for me because I take some action now. I don't just complain, but I write some letters or something. And it's amazing that you do get responses mm-hmm. to things. Mm-hmm. And so I can thank Holden for that, and maybe it'll make some kind of an impact. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing. It really surprised me how mad I got standing at Target in the checkout line going, what do you mean you don't have paper?
Yeah.
And it's amazing too, because it also gives you an opportunity to explain to these clerks or something, this is why I don't like the plastic thing.
A lot of cities banning plastic containers. Twin Cities have it's all set up now. 1990 or 91, there'd be no more plastic containers in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and a lot of the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. So they're going back to paper.
Yeah, yeah. Quite sure what they're
doing.
It's not next month.
No, not plastic anyway.
Uh-huh. We should be packaging our groceries in macrame bags and bringing our own bags.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's the real answer in a lot of ways, because a lot of ways people are really hard on them the same way, really hard on plastic and styrofoam, and say, use paper. But in fact, the paper comes from, we have to cut the trees and make the paper, and it gets thrown in the dump, and it decomposes anaerobically and makes all kinds of nasty byproducts. So in some ways, you know, the best way out of it is not to throw it away or redo it. Like here, paper's okay, we burn it, so it's better than burying it. But at other places, like, you know, but paper's no free lunch either. Mm-hmm. Pay for that too. So.
I ran into that at Target too, and I was just buying a roll of film, and just a little roll of film, and they wanted to put it in a bag and all that stuff, and I said, I don't need this. And this clerk got very upset. I said, well, they're going to stop you walking out of the store. I said, well, give me the receipt, I'll be fine. And he said, well, you know, you'll get in trouble for this. And they didn't stop me. but that's real true. There's so many times they give you a bag. You don't need a bag. Throw it in something.
We're hearing some hopeful stories here. Are there people who feel overwhelmed by it? Or go ahead.
Well, I was feeling overwhelmed, and I thought, well, what on earth can we do, and why do anything? And I called the University of Minnesota, I can't remember what department, but it had to do with the recycling and so forth. And they said, just remember that every time you use something one more time than you would have before you throw it away, you cut in half your garbage on that item. And that really put things a little bit more in perspective for me. A tablecloth at church, if we use them more than once, and, you know, you cut in half what you would have had otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
Jody, who was it here last year from Chicago who talked about the number of thick shavers that are... they were talking about the solid waste problem in Chicago. I was just astounded. I can't remember what the figure was, but the numbers of something per day.
She had one figure that it was hundreds of thousands of those little disposable Bic, which I just shaved with tonight.
Per day
in the city of Chicago. It was an incredible number. You wouldn't believe it.
I live in Santa Rosa, California. For the last 10 years, we've had as a community, had a recycling program, paper, glass, cans, metal, aluminum. And we have, I keep it right inside the garage, and there's three boxes, paper here, cans, or bottles, I don't know, whatever. I can tell it's yellow and green, and that worked out fine. But then now, 2 years ago, they came around with, now we have these great big garbage trucks that come around. They have an arm, and we have, like, let's call it a granny. We have a garbage can that is about this big around and about this tall, and they used to come around once a week, and we could have two cans, but this granny unit holds like four cans. So my goodness, immediately people start, we can dump more stuff in here. And the garbage and everything that you threw away, it more than doubled, because now we have...
One thing that you can do, you can vote. I live in Oregon, and we have a recyclable bottles. We the pop cans and the pop bottles, and so if the vote comes up in your state to have recycling, you can do that, because I go to other California where they do not have it.
They do too.
They do.
Read the cans.
You don't have to pay for the cans. They only recycle. Yeah,
we're worth a nickel and you turn them in.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
Washington doesn't have it though.
But anyway, I'm surprised at how many cans and things that I see in states where they do not have that bottle bill. And at home, you don't see very many cans sitting around, and they reuse them. And kids make money by finding cans and selling them. So it is, you can vote and help that way.
Mm-hmm. Also, just recycling helps a lot. If you recycle newspaper and glass, things like that in your home communities, it really helps your local recycler. I attended a seminar on plastics recycling last fall. Holden Village paid my way to this kind of highfalutin seminar, so it was kind of amusing.
You had a suit and a tie. it was in the Hilton SeaTac.
There's an article in the paper. Someone lived in Seattle, sent me an article in the paper that is plastic seminar. So I said, talked to Ken about getting that. It was kind of expensive. I got like $25, which means really expensive. Anyway, because I was a garbologist to see what was going on. It was a day seminar. I went to this place, everybody had suits on. I had sandals and shorts, I think. Cut-off shorts. It looked like that. They talked about recycling plastics, and they said a lot of plastics could be recycled if people would recycle them. They could afford to recycle them. Like local recyclers could afford to take certain types of plastics if they can get enough participation. Mm-hmm. The same with glass, cardboard, everything else. Because recycling is profitable if you have the volume.
Not paper anymore.
What's that?
Not paper anymore. It's costing more to haul it away now than it's worth.
They still pay for it some places, though. You still...
Not in our community, because everybody's recycling paper, and now it's just...
But so again, some of that is...
Like newspaper.
Again, if we look at it in a different way, for instance, it's hard to get rid of newsprint in Seattle, but we have a paper that publishes on Virgin Print, and if they would print on recycled paper, there'd be a lot more demand for recycled paper. So there are other ways to go about it. If newspapers would, for example, print, if there'd be more demand for recycled products, to even letterhead and things to print on, recycled newspaper would have a little more of a market.
I think our paper is recycled.
Is it?
Yeah. And then we have a policy that we buy only recycled paper that has been recycled, and then figured out there's a way to recycle bulletins. You stack them up and then mm-hmm. we save them and recycle them. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One other aspect of this is that, as I understand it, current subsidies in the lumber industry make the cost of lumber such that virgin paper is about as cheap as recycled
yeah.
paper. So if that recycling is being undermined by price supports for the lumber industry.
Oh, I guess the thing that disturbs me, I had a solid waste management class my last term in school, and the thing that really struck me that was really brought out, and what I hear a lot, is that we've got to stop trying to recycle, trying to make a profit at it or trying to break even. We've got to do it just because we have to do it. And for the individual, it might never be worth it monetarily to turn in your newspapers and sort out. I mean, it saves a lot of time. You just throw it all in the can and say, get rid of it. You know, I'm willing to pay the sanitation department to take it away. But we've got to do it because we have to do it. And if it's not profitable, then we're just going to have to pay for it, because when we buy it, it's our responsibility, and if we have to pay to get rid of it, then we have to accept that.
So it's a question of ethics.
Right.
What's irritating me is this internal combustion engine. We're all tied up with cars and trucks and other buses, etc. And I think there's, maybe I'm just paranoid, I think there's a big hidden agenda that we have to stick with this kind of vehicle, and I don't agree with that. I think there's obviously non-polluting type of transportation somewhere. And I was really surprised in the last Newsweek from last week said that industry produces 15% of the nation's smog, but cars produce 40%. And every time we go anywhere in our vehicles, we're just contributing to that 40% of the total. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, that's irritating. How can we lobby and maneuver and get some kind of clean energy vehicle transportation in our society? Mm-hmm. There's too many axes to grind. There's too many industries involved. There's lots of political pressure.
Even that kind of thing, though, in some ways, the alternative, the best alternative, like for right now, is just use what we have less.
Less.
Because so much, because like that 40%, I mean, so much of it is just silly little trips people drive instead of take the bus, because mm-hmm. it's a little bit nicer, or they feel more, they're more macho or whatever with their, you know, driving their truck than taking the bus.
If we had alternatives, though, for those people who would never even consider cutting back, this is what I'm saying.
Well, I think that's where it comes to what Rick was saying. If it costs what it costs in Europe to buy a gallon of gas, then people will start to say, gee, you know, it's going to cost me, you know, X amount of money to go see Granny this weekend. I'll save it for next weekend or whatever. I think that's one of the problems, and I don't understand quite why we can't get behind increasing the real cost of gasoline and using the money that is generated to produce public transportation and other things.
But the scandals of pulling out trolley lines and other kinds of things because of the internal combustion engine lobby, I mean, it's just yeah. ridiculous.
Some of it, I think, that we see, we see it here at Holden a bit, and it doesn't really relate to energy saving, although it does in another aspect, is that people have a real hard time when we try to tell them what to do. When they feel that their freedoms are being restricted but somehow by saying that you can't shower between at this time because the dish team's running, you're only going to have one tank of hot water a day, the house can only be this warm. Well, you can't make people do that. It's impossible. You can't. It's
But you have to give them the choices.
That's right. Here we're at this enlightened spot in the mountains, and we can't keep people to keep their plastic on the windows. We can't keep the storm windows up. Or you come along and there's slits in the storm windows. It's really irritating. But there's folks just do not want to be made to do things. And we go through this in community decisions too, when we try to decide I think this would be a good collective thing to do. Somebody says, no way. And so we have a real hard time being told that this is good for us and we should do it, I think.
Jackie and Jody?
Well, I was just going to say that the mentality of being able to buy what we want was hit home just this last weekend when I was out, and there was a guest, a woman who's going to be working on a project in the fall up here, whose husband in Wenatchee wants to hike in, and he has a pretty big responsible job with the government in Wenatchee and wants to be able to get out of here as fast as he can and back to Wenatchee. And I was telling him what the bus schedule was and the boat, when he'd get where and when he'd get to Fields Point and all of this. And he says, oh, well, I want to fly out of Lucerne, so I'm going to need a ride down there. And I said, well, we don't provide any special transportation. You'll have to go when the bus goes to make the boat. And he says, well, I can pay. He says, you know, what will it cost me to be able to fly out of there? And was being pretty persistent about that. And I said, well, you know, we really try to conserve on fuel and the wear and tear in our vehicles. And he was pretty dissatisfied with my response and just wanted to really increase the money he would be willing to pay to get the Holden staff to have a special drive down there for him so he could get back to his job. And I mean, I think it really challenges people. They don't understand this or understand the effort. Because in most of the things out there, you can just purchase that privilege.
Let him hire a chopper. He's got that much to throw out.
That's a good answer. Just following up briefly on some of the comments that Rick was making earlier, that one of the real challenges, it seems to me, is how we get beyond this point of what is clearly a global crisis being only a matter of individual choice. And one of the impressive things to me about Holden is that Holden is one of the few places that I know of which, as an entire institution, has decided to move in some directions. And sure, some people resisted, and there are some people with some cracks in the windows and so forth. We all have our cracks in our windows. But it is an entire organization move in this direction and some kind of reharmonizing with the ecosystem. One quick success story, a couple of us who've been here from Chicago in past years have been talking in a variety of ways about how you adapt what's good about Holden organizationally into a chaotic place like Chicago. It's huge and absolutely unmanageable and mostly depressing ecologically, right? All kinds of depressing stories could be told. But what we obviously came upon after some thought and discussion together is that what we have in Chicago and all cities is a series of institutions which are in themselves sort of envelopes. And you can manage institutions, whether they are congregations or seminaries or corporations or small businesses or restaurants. So we've begun in some institutions in Chicago to facilitate their thinking about becoming green zones. And this conversation has begun now at the Lutheran School of Theology, the seminary in Chicago. And they are going to spend the next couple of years thinking as a full community about the theology of creation and about our obligations to the entire ecosystem. And then they're going to take, you know, the opening theology course for freshmen may be refrigerators, right? Mm. And what you do with refrigerators, where they come from, where the coolant come from, what sort of options to refrigeration and high energy use in that way there might be. And somebody else might take electricity and lights the entire building so that the sort of sense of the organization moving on an issue. It seems to me that the political atmosphere, the time is exactly right for congregations and for all kinds of organizations to move sort of beyond the individual choice level and to challenge themselves as Holden has done. Mm-hmm.
But it's to take these things that have become for people since about 1930, they've become invisible.
because I know that my father, who was a boy in the 20s, still understands most of the basic machinery of our civilization, short of computers. He stops there. But I don't. I don't understand refrigerators. I don't understand internal combustion engines. And I think it might be helpful to it's wonderful to be at Holden where people around here, peers of mine, understand this joint and understand how it operates and also understand how to save money with it, how to keep it running effectively and efficiently. And I think that, to me, is a real exciting thing to see. That, and in fact, our theology is one of incarnation, that you ought to know how things work. You shouldn't sort of be up here in some spiritual realm talking about, God is saving the universe, but rather, I am part, in my vocation and what I do, the wrenches that I turn or the food that I cook, I am partner with God in making creation holy. God is using me. I think that's very important.
Is there, the recycling of, or the composting, is there enough, do you get enough of this stuff to, you're just in flower beds or the garden area, or is there enough of that to, is there a possibility that someday you could even be more, that there, you could get enough to market this stuff? Yeah, I do too.
I mean, I guess our goal is not to have too much, because then, in effect, we're just bringing up more food.
Right.
You know, and then, I mean, it's ending up on the garden.
Yeah. It doesn't last long, the garden. I've had my own kind of post pile going for years, and it's always kind of fun. I enjoy showing off my worms. And
well, really, I'd like to say that somebody said last year in one of these sessions, and I don't know who it was exactly, but it was a pretty good point that there's no free lunch in ecology or conservation. Like people want to throw some magical thing to make a saved environment and have things just as convenient as we have it now. Nothing works that way. Recycling, not using stuff, you have to be willing to make the sacrifice for the good of the whole thing. There's no free ride out of it, like with the transportation or whatever. You have to be willing to do some living convenience to make the thing work.
Yeah, I think of my time when I was in Denmark, because my Danish family was the regular middle class family, and I think I was in their car maybe once, and I was there for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming home from a trip. I went with the program, and I was at the airport, and it was a long way home. It would take me maybe 2 hours to go. It would 20 minutes in the car, and they wouldn't pick me up. So I went the 2 hours and I was tired. But now that I think about it, you know, that's what you have to do. You know, you have to give up that a little time and make the extra effort.
It's worth it in the long run. Worth it for your kids and your grandkids.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of how I was before I came to Holden. I was pretty ignorant about this stuff, except what I learned in school. And I remember being in high school in 1977, 78, and we had I remember there was a paper shortage, and we used all, like, we didn't use virgin paper, we used all recyclable paper, and we kept using paper over and over again, and I remember it was a big effort of our school, and yet, it seemed like that disappeared. I mean, it was, like, instantly gone, and that's what I remember that, you know, the gas prices going up to $1.55 instantly, and all been driving. And now we all drive as much as we used to, and a lot of us, a lot of people do. And it seems like there's a crisis, and we all pull together. And I think it would continue if we really felt it was real, but it seems somehow in the economics of it all to disappear. And it doesn't seem real anymore. So it becomes that cry wolf kind of thing. There's a big part of that, and it's just really getting people to believe that no matter what it looks like, the reality is it's here.
What was that Jimmy Carter phrase, the something of war, the ethic, the
moral equivalent
of war, right? What was he talking about?
He was talking about justice in the world, wasn't it? About people being tortured and stuff.
I'm not sure, but the moral equivalent of war, the sense that this is so important that we would respond the same way as if we were being attacked by an enemy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we are the enemy. You know, we've seen the enemy, and the enemy is us.
On Rick's forum the other night, it was awfully sobering for me to think that if we don't take hold and do some of these things, the only alternative to keep the greenhouse effect or whatever from happening, all these other things, is a world government that's going to say only 1 point so many children yeah. per family and only so many gallons of gas mm-hmm. per month and and yeah, laws which, down the yin yang, you know.
Which would be, totalitarianism.
Yeah.
One more comment and then we'll quit.
Could we have a commitment from one of this group to have a technical hike either tomorrow or Thursday? Mm-hmm. I'm gone Friday.
Why don't we come down here right afterwards and maybe Jerry and folks can meet here and talk about the possibilities? Thanks for coming out here tonight, and I hope that you'll all take a moment to look at the styrofoam poster up in the dining hall, because it gives you some suggestions for dealing with that particular issue, and some funny letters, actually, and responses to McDonald's. I hope that you'll also keep your eyes and ears open in the time you're here at Holden. I hope that these people, too, the operations staff, will talk more about what's going on, because this really is a wonderful gift and commitment that Holden is doing and needs to be more part of our everyday life and consciousness here. Thanks.